taking you for walks in the park, ever, that he's really a serial abuser.
You need a different source. Guerrilla Radio, a century of news every Thursday and Saturday.
And welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, the Orange Emperor sent his estate agents round to the Kremlin yesterday, ostensibly to negotiate the spoils of Ukraine's remains following nearly 4 years of war. Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner were received by President Putin. And after their five-hour meeting, Putin spokesperson Yuri Ushakov said only that the meeting was constructive. Putin himself dampened hopes of any settlement based on the proposed U.S. peace plan, telling attendees at Moscow's VTB Investment Forum shortly before meeting the Witkoff delegation, the American plan was unacceptable. John Helmer is a journalist and author who spent decades living in and reporting from Russia. He's the principal behind the web news site Dances with Bears, and his many book titles include The Man Who Knows Too Much About Russia, The Lie That Shot Down MH17, Skripal and Prison, the Skripal sequel, Long Live Novichok, the British Poison That Fooled the World, and his latest, The Navalny-Novichok Complex, Chronicle of a Staging. John's latest article at Dances with Bears, by the Versailles Treaty Standard, How to Judge the End of War Terms the U.S. is Offering, examines the guts of the Putin-Witkoff-Kushner exercise in Russia. Welcome back to the program, John.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Well, you know, it's always my pleasure. John, your article's allusion to the Versailles Treaty that concluded World War I makes me wonder just who's claiming victory in Ukraine right now. It seems to me there's no losers here.
It's an unusual situation, yes, where the U.S. side, and we have to keep repeating this, Trump is in retreat. Trump and the Trump administration cannot allow any other outcome to a foreign policy maneuver than win-win-win. Win-win is what Trump has announced many times over. He does, he won, he said on the deck of USS Harry Truman last month, we won World War I, we won World War II, we won the wars before, we won the wars after, and we would have won Vietnam and we would have won Afghanistan if not for a failure of will. So Trump is trying to find a way to retreat from the appearance and the reality of losing the war. He has extracted the US from paying for it by obliging the Europeans, if they want to fight on, as he says, to pay the US for the arms and wherewithal to fight on. And in this particular case, he sent Stephen Witkoff and Jared Kushner to Moscow. The reception that you referred to, Yuri Ushakov's readout, has several bits in it which are very unusual. Ushakov is not a national security advisor in the Kissinger-Brzezinski style. He is more a spokesman for the president, and he is rarely ever critical of the U.S. side in these talks. This time, he's critical. This time, he basically accuses the U.S. of failing to demonstrate, using his words, a sincere desire for cooperation on the economic warfare, sanctions warfare front. He referred to Witkoff as Mr. Witkoff, but referred to Kushner as Jared. There are three points that I'm drawing from his readout that are unusual. He is now critical of the U.S. plan as not having met Russian approval. He is critical of the U.S. for insincerity on business deals, and he distinguishes between Witkoff and Kushner in a very peculiar way. So the outcome from the Russian side, there's so far no reaction from Trump's side. The reaction from the Russian side is clear. The Russian side aims to go on moving militarily to the solution of the war.
Well, John, we've talked many times before, you've always reinforced the subtlety of Russian statecraft, how words mean so much more than we in the West perhaps take credit for, and how they're sticklers for decorum and so forth. I wonder why on earth Putin gave an audience to these underlings of Trump. I mean, doesn't that break the whole idea, the protocol of interstate relations? Shouldn't he be speaking with Trump and not these surrogates?
You're right to notice the protocol issue here, Chris. You could recall over these many months, Trump has tried to compel or pressure Putin into direct summit meeting. Those efforts have been responded to with the Russian view. And Ushakov's repeated it again, that you can't have a summit meeting without careful work to establish in advance what you will agree on. Summits, the Russian side have agreed, are okay for grandstanding and public relations. President Putin has even endorsed Trump's bid for a Nobel Peace Prize, but without the so-called preparatory work, that's to say without clarity on the specifics of agreement, in this case to end the war, there can't be a summit meeting. And that's been the position. Second, we've seen attempts from the U.S. side on the part of Secretary of State, National Security Advisor Marco Rubio, to box Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov in with relatively limited contacts, first across the table and then by telephone, without any significant detailed agreement. So at the diplomatic level, at the Rubio-Lavrov level, there's been no movement for weeks and weeks. Trump prefers to have Witkoff continue to negotiate, as he's been doing, with Putin. Putin has been very hospitable to the messenger, making the messenger almost as welcome as a higher ranking official. Remember, Kushner has no rank at all. Kushner was a ranking official in the first Trump term, but he has no rank at all in the second. he is remains, let's say, a profiteer from his own affinity partners' funds, investments in the Middle East with the counterparties he's been negotiating with, particularly the Saudis, the Emiratis, and the Qataris, but he has no official standing. To receive him is basically a Russian politeness instead of Trump himself. But there's no evidence that Kushner opens his mouth, says anything. That man has been talkative only on endorsement of the U.S.-Israeli genocide of Gaza and the purported peace plan in Gaza. He's had nothing to say on the Ukraine-Russia war. So it's a politeness on the Russian side. Now, why, go back to your question, Chris, is President Putin doing this? Answer, very simply, he's talking to Russian voters. He's talking to the Russian man in the street. And the opinion polls right through November indicate, on the one hand, a very strong commitment to ending the war on terms that will protect Russia for future generations. That's a phrase that Putin's spokesman Dmitry Peskov gave in 5 hours before the meeting that has taken place this week, in remarks to Indian correspondents. The Russian side want a long-lasting peace settlement, not simply a temporary ceasefire. Russian voters, Russian public, believe that Putin and the Russian army are doing as good a job as it's possible to do, and support for the army correlates directly with support for President Putin. But those polls, the poll for Putin, the poll for government, support for the government's performance and the prime minister's performance, is beginning to turn down in Russia. And that's a signal of internal domestic dissent and trouble in the economic situation. So Putin has to demonstrate to the domestic constituencies that he's doing everything possible to negotiate a peace deal with the US, but that if it fails, he's not to blame. Trump is to blame. That's the domestic message Putin is trying to send out. And that's why he's received two messenger boys.
Well, in your article, you say, and I'll quote you loosely, that the picture of Witkoff and Kushner smiling across the table at Putin, Usakov, and Dmitriev is understood by the Russian voters to show the enemy's money is doing the talking, as opposed to the generals, as you add parenthetically later. Can you describe or explain what you mean here?
What I mean is how to say this quickly. It's very clear that the U.S. side sent serious generals to the Ukraine and with a message for Zelensky. And that was a new approach that was devised principally by Vice President Vance. He is the real source of intelligence and briefing for President Trump. Trump likes seeing pictures, and he has very great trouble thinking by reading. What Vance did was to send his former university classmate, Daniel Driscoll, the U.S. Army Secretary, along with two active generals, General George, the Army Chief of Staff, and General Donahue, the U.S. Army Commander for Europe and Central Asia, to Zelensky, to Kiev. And their message basically was, come to the terms we are trying to negotiate so that you will can survive. We, the U.S., cannot assure that we can go on protecting you from the advancing Russian defeat that the Russian side is able to inflict on you. That was a serious warning and a serious message for Zelensky that the U.S. hasn't attempted before. This is the way in which the U.S. changed its approach to Zelensky. The Europeans have basically said to Zelensky, we will support you, we will finance you, we will help you continue to fight in the belief that Putin can be dissuaded or defeated on the battlefield. The U.S. position is that whatever the outcome of the fight, the U.S. will not pay for a defeat and will not appear publicly to be running away from Kiev, as the U.S. had to run away from Saigon in 1975 or run away from Kabul in Afghanistan in the Biden administration. This is the message of the U.S. generals. They have not so far come to Moscow or met with the counterpart Russian generals. Igor Kostyakov, the chief of the General Staff's Military Intelligence Agency, has been at the negotiating table. He was last seen at the negotiating table in Istanbul. So the Russians are ready, if the U.S. generals are ready, to discuss the territorial limitation of the post-war Ukraine. They're ready to discuss caps on the military capabilities of the surviving Ukrainian army. But if they're not there, and they weren't there this week, and Witkoff and Kushner are not military, then there's a very serious limit on the detail which can be discussed. So that's the point of the generals. The U.S. side is making the general's message audible to the Ukraine side, but not to the Russian side yet. So the Russian side says, we aren't yet discussing the wording or specific American proposals. That's the exact words Ushakov issued in his readout there for the December two meeting.
Yeah, which makes me wonder, you know, 5 hours is a long time. Are they just carving the turkey, so to speak? If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with John Helmer. John's a journalist and author. He's spent decades living in and reporting from Russia. He's the principal behind the web news site Dances with Bears. His many book titles include The Man Who Knows Too Much About Russia, The Lie That Shot Down MH17, Skripal in Prison, and Long Live Novichok, The British Poison That Fooled the World, and The Navalny-Novichok Complex, chronicling of a staging. We're speaking today in and around his latest article by the Versailles Treaty Standard, How to Judge the End of War Terms the U.S. is Offering. Well, John, Trump's triumph of the will aside, Canadian Prime Minister Carney, the CBC radio reported this morning, it has not admitted the impending defeat of the Ukraine regime. In fact, he says Canada will supply $200 million Canadian dollars more worth of military gear and $300 million Canadian dollars more of some other aid that was not really specified, totaling $500 million on top of the what Eve Engler approximates to be the $50 billion Canadian dollars that have already been funneled down the loo in Ukraine. So is this just a matter of Trump getting what he wants yet again and getting suckers like Canada to pick up the tab?
I think the short answer to that, Chris, is yes. Just as Trump cannot face his U.S. voters with a lose-lose outcome to the Ukraine war, the relatively weak, politically weak coalitions ruling in the European, British, and Canadian government headquarters cannot be seen to, in front of their voters, to accept a humiliating loss, a humiliating loss of huge amounts of taxpayer money. And the other part, that they must appear to be doing their bit, so to speak, in order to negotiate tariff relief, economic trade relief with Trump. So Trump is extorting very large sums of money, first to continue the war, not only the war against Russia on the Ukraine battlefield, but the war against Russia in Poland, in Finland, across the Arctic Circle, to the Far East. Trump doesn't intend to end the war with Russia. He intends to sequence the war so as to compel the Europeans to pay the U.S. to arm it, arm the fight on, and to compel the Europeans to do whatever he wants in Europe in order to earn themselves tariff relief, to preserve themselves from the rising Trump tariff wall. So Carney has, in reversing everything he campaigned for in the last Canadian election, is trying to mollify Trump for economic purposes in order to not to trigger a massive Canadian reaction. And you've had Eve Engler and other guests to explain that domestic Canadian reaction as Trump inflicts serious economic damage on Canada. So it's an extortion on the Trump part. And Carney is demonstrating that he can play the patsy. And the patsy, the bill for playing the patsy, as Carney has presented it in his new defense budget, in his public statements, in his promises to throw more Canadian taxpayer money down the Ukraine toilet, as you've just said, Chris, this is a display of Canadian weakness in the face of American extortion. But that's to defend Canada was Carney's campaign asset. He won the prime ministry after defeating Chrystia Freeland, who's now run away to a job in England. He defeated Freeland, who had disposed of Trudeau for beforehand. He then won the election, but not so convincingly, on the basis he would be more effective in defending Canada from the United States. Instead, he's proving to be a very expensive patsy at Canada's expense.
Well, the coalition of the Quislings is not just Canada, of course, it is Europe. And I mentioned at the top that President Putin of Russia was at this investment forum, the VTB investment forum, and he was giving remarks just before going to this Vitkov. And so this was clearly telegraphing to them what to expect. One of his remarks, though, and you include in your article too, is he sent a shot clear across the bow of the Europeans regarding their belligerence. And he said that the Europeans have no peace agenda. They are on the side of war. But he was sure to include that if that was the case, Russia was, and he says, we are ready. A rather ominous statement to make. Are we ready for a war, a real war between Europe and Russia?
Well, I think that it's a good question, Chris. And the Europeans are not ready. They say they're not ready. Germany is proposing to introduce conscription. Each of the European states is not ready to pay the Ukraine bill without their forces deployed. So they must increase their manpower. They must increase their rearmament. And what they want to do right now in covering the ballooning cost is to steal Russian assets in order to pay the bill. And the various formulas that have been proposed all relate to the final theft of the $300 billion Russian Central Bank reserves, which were allegedly frozen, then confiscated, and now being used in part to finance the war. So the Europeans are running out of men, of weapons, readiness, and public support for taxpayer money to be spent on this massive rearmament program that can only be justified by a threat that Russia proposes to invade Europe. Russia proposes to attack Europe. Now, you've led the way, Chris. We've in our attempts to explain to our audience that each of these countries have used fabricated stories of Russian threat to create national consensus behind the level of spending that's been undergone to date. The Novichok story in England was meant to convince Britons that Russia was ready to use chemical warfare weapons in attack on British territory. The Germans tried the same Novichok fabrication when they received Alexei Navalny for the fabricated story that he had been poisoned by Novichok and was his life saved only in a clinic in Berlin. These were all devices, schemes, myths, lies designed to build public support for this massive attempt to realign Europe with the United States in a continuing war with Russia. Well, what can I say? We've explained it. You've explained it. But each of these lies has continued to be believed. You're alone, almost alone. Eve Engler is almost alone politically in Canada in pointing out the lies, in pointing out the fabrication, the deceit. Trump has simply capitalized on Europe's readiness to continue the deceit by extorting even more benefit from each of his allies. What more to say? This is a long episode in a continuing war to the destruction of Russia in Europe, destruction of the Russian-German partnership, which threatened U.S. hegemony in Europe. This war has been continuing since the Bolshevik Revolution, going through different stages over different periods. Here we are now, however, the Russian army is demonstrating it can defeat everything that NATO allies put on the battlefield. Now, what President Putin's warning amounted to was, if you engage directly against us, we go to war against you. And that's a warning of nuclear retaliation and the use of the Oreshnik, the weapon against which the Europeans and the United States have no defense. So it's a combination of, you want to go to war with us on the Ukrainian battlefield directly, and you want to go to war with us on the Polish battlefield, on the Finnish battlefield. We're ready. Are you ready for nuclear warfare? Are you ready for the Oreshnik? That's what Putin was saying. We are ready. Are you? And the answer he already knows is the Europeans are not ready. They're ready to lie, but not to fight.
Yes, and well, and he was quick to say that the surgical precision, as he describes what's been the Russian military approach in Ukraine has been, will not be applied in a European war. And he warns, geez, we could have this dilemma where we, quote, very quickly will be left with no one to negotiate with on the other side. John, we're fast out of time. I direct everyone to John's interview with Nima Al-Khorshid over at Dialogue Works on YouTube. Check that out. You talked to him yesterday. You're just back from India, and I really appreciate you getting up after such a quick turnaround in time zones and travel and all the rest of that. Thanks a lot for coming on today, and I hope we can touch base before the new year again, perhaps, about Putin's trip to India, which is later this week too.
Thank you very much again, Chris. Yes, let's get back together again to discuss India, because on that front, Russia is developing a new relationship, trying to balance India and worry that Russia is too balanced in the direction of China. There are many things to discuss. Believe it or not, on the single day in which we've been discussing, December 2, the meeting, there were significant meetings between Russia and China in Moscow and Russia and India when Peskov briefed Indian correspondents. So there's lots to talk about following President Putin's visit to Delhi, which begins December 4 and continues through December 5. Let's get back together. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, my pleasure. Yeah, the world's spinning faster and faster. Thanks, too, to you, Eve Engler. That's all I've got for this time. Until the next time.